Welcome to Season 7 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Daniel Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
AwPlay has a Kickstarter launching soon featuring River Valley Jewelcraft, a new standalone game in the River Valley universe where players control a worker moving through the mines collecting gems to refine into artisan jewelry. Players upgrade their mines by collecting tiles and competing to collect jewelry cards for victory points. Whoever has the highest score wins. Then there's Things on Strings, where one player is the knower and everyone else is the finder. The knower selects a category and divides four words into two groups of two, based on a rule only they know. The finders place their cards in the two groups, hoping they match and deduce the category. When a pile gets to four cards, it splits again. Players go until either five categories are completed or the finders make five mistakes. And finally, there's Some Assembly Required, where you're moving from your family home to your own apartment, but it's empty. Players take turns collecting furniture cards and tiles to assemble their furniture and place it on their apartment boards. Follow the feng shui flow of the room and add decor to score. The most points wins, so look out for them on Kickstarter. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, Episode 138, Song Survivor. Today we are joined by Edwin Benton, game designer and CEO of Doing the Most Games. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm super happy to have you. And for anyone who doesn't know who you are, how you got into starting to design games, I'd love to know about that journey.
Okay. I used to be really into apps. I used to be addicted to a game called Words with Friends and wanted to play slang words, and it doesn't allow you. So I created an app called Slang and Friends that allowed you to play slang words, and it would give you the definitions from not just any slang, but slang from all around the world, categorized. And if you played a slang word and it didn't work, you can add it right there in the app. It was a super fun game. It did really well the first 30 days, and then it kind of died out after that. And then I pivoted the company to tabletop card games because that was kind of taking off at the time with Exploding Kittens and their big Kickstarter that they did. I think it was like $8 or $9 million.
Wow. What an interesting pivot. But I also love the fact that you homeruled something you enjoyed, created an app off of it. That is very much what people do in board games when they first start out.
Yeah, now you can make the same app that I spent thousands on for nothing. I spent 3 years and you can do the same app in like 10 minutes. It's crazy.
It is wild how much technology is changing, and it's a little scary.
It's very scary, yes.
Okay, so then you pivot the company. You're making board games. Was Song Survivor the first?
No, our very first game was, our flagship game was Doing the Most, same name as the company, and it was a drinking party card game, and we made every mistake that a game designer can make all in one game.
Tell me more. What are these mistakes?
It took us forever to make it. We tried to do too much. It's really like 10 games in one. Each card is a different game in itself, so it's kind of all over the place. It's fun, but it's kind of, when we look back at it, we'll never make that kind of game again.
Okay. It sounds like you had a lot of good lessons that you applied to future games, such as Song Survivor, which is our main spotlight for this episode. For anyone who hasn't played it, would you mind going over the rules for the game?
It's super simple, and that's what we try to do with all our games, just keep it really simple. But in short, every card has a word on it, and all you have to do is sing a song that has that word in it, or a song from an artist that has that word in the artist's name. And you go clockwise. And yeah, and the trick is to sing a song that everyone else knows.
So they can't use it?
Well, people like singing along. And when people sing along, then you're more likely to be chosen as the winner because you picked a fun song.
Oh, interesting. So it's not like a categories where we have to all say different songs and knock each other out, like in the Pitch Perfect movies. I guess that's where my mind was going.
Yeah, no, it's not like that at all. We just wanted to create a fun and super simple game that anyone can play. And really, it's just about coming up with a great song that people know.
I would be so bad at this game. I am terrible at remembering lyrics. I'm really good at karaoke when I can read the lyrics, though.
Well, you can kind of hum along, and then if it's a song that people know, then they'll start singing along, and then the words will come back, and then everyone will start singing it. And that's kind of how the game came about. Like, me and my friends were at dinner in Costa Rica, and we were just playing around, and we started naming songs that were different words. So we threw words out there, and we said love, and then my friend goes, I love LA, and he starts singing that song. And then, like, a guy from across the restaurant runs over and joins in and starts singing with him. And then two other people from different tables started singing. So then everybody was singing. I was like, there's something to this. And so, yeah, we created a game out of it.
I was going to say, how much drinking was involved on this island trip?
It was actually zero, to be honest.
Oh, okay. In my mind, I'm imagining, like, a bar.
No, we were just sitting down at dinner. And it was just one of those random moments that you can't script.
That's awesome. I feel like one of my favorite things when I play test a game out in public, which I know it wasn't a game at that point, but when someone just like looks at it, wants to join in or starts asking questions, that's how you know you have something.
Yeah, for sure.
So what was the next step? You have people join in on your sing-along. Did you like immediately go to your notebook, go to a computer? Where did you go from there?
No, it kind of just sat with me for a little bit. And then I start, you know, asking people that were there, like, what do you think of, you know, making this into a game? And then they kind of give their thoughts and like, yeah, sure. And then the first step, we always prototype with like pieces of paper and, you know, whatever is around. And then, you know, we kind of play that and get feedback. And if that goes well, then the next step is coming up with the physical prototype. And then we test, and then we do another prototype, and then we kind of just do that. And then, but it's all about the testing. We do a lot of testing before we really decide to make a game.
Okay. And what kind of tests do you tend to run? Like, how do you decide that this is the one that you want to invest money, not just time in?
Yeah, so we just get our friends together, and then, you know, we have parties, we play it, we get feedback, and then we have their friends' friends throw a party, and then we'll show up, and we won't tell them that we made the game. We just show up and kind of, we do secret tests. And that's important because if they know you made the game, the tests are always going to be great. They're always going to love it because they know you're in the room. So we like to play it around people that we don't know, and we don't tell them who we are until the very, very end. And that's how we get the best feedback. And usually if they like it, then we move forward and we do the same thing about 5 to 10 more times.
Very cool. So for you, it's a little bit like a blind play test. Is it typically the person running the party is someone that's already played the game and they're just reteaching it, or are they teaching it from a rule book that you've written up?
It just depends. Sometimes it's getting harder to find people to throw parties. So we have to kind of pay for everything now and bribe people to do these things, people we don't know. But they agree to it. We're like, hey, you know, free alcohol and pizza, you know, are you down? And then they'll do it. And, you know, we just ask that they don't tell anyone who we are until the very end. And it's been very valuable for us.
I love that it's a party atmosphere. Is that because the games you're working on are party games?
Absolutely. Yeah. All the games are pretty much party games. But we're looking at developing games that are not party games, more games for people with disabilities, which is a population that I care about deeply. So that's pretty interesting of, you know, just looking into what games we can create for those markets.
That is super cool. Yeah, I feel like for me, I'm also a game designer, and I work on a lot of, I call them social games, which is an umbrella term I use for party games, deduction, light deduction, card games, kind of like Uno. And I feel like playtesting in the atmosphere in which these games should be played and will most likely be played really does help. Because if you bring a party game to a party and no one's laughing, I don't think you did it right.
100%.
Yeah. No, so I think that's really interesting that that's where you kind of focus. I know that everyone goes about playtesting differently. Like, there are conventions made for playtesting. So it's like, is a convention the right time to playtest a party game? A lot of times, those are more strategy gamers that want to play these games that are heavy Euros that might take multiple hours to play. So they are not going to give the same kind of feedback as the average consumer that will go through Target, see a pretty box and go, ooh, I want to buy that. It's only $20. This is going to be tonight's party. So once you've landed on a game, how do you figure out the aesthetic for it? And I'm talking packaging, the box, what it looks like, how you're going to market it, especially for Song Survivor.
That's a great question. We look at games that are similar to ours, see what other people have done, but we really have invested in working with professionals. So we have someone on our team that's designed a lot of the top games that you see in Target and Walmart. And so that allows us to focus on the actual game itself and the marketing plan and not so much the design. And he's great. He's really amazing, actually. So that's kind of what we do. We leave it to the professionals.
I think that's great to hire someone that you know has a proven track record. Do you do more of your sales online or in person?
Online. We do most of our sales on Amazon, probably 90% on Amazon, and then the rest on our website.
How do you build an Amazon page that's going to pull people in?
We go to the pros. That's just the best thing. We tried our best. We've tried AI, but the reality of it is there's just insights that people have that's been doing this for years that these small tweaks make a big difference. So we really just kind of invest in that. And every dollar that the company makes, we put it back into the company. So we're not truly profitable. We just want to have the best games possible. And then we think that it'll pay off in the long run.
That's super cool, especially when it's something sold online. I feel like you have to create a box that looks good as a thumbnail versus if it's sold at like a Target. You want it to appear on the shelf because you're looking at so many other things. There's so much noise visually. So I'm always curious how people decide aesthetics on what the game looks like when they're self-publishing.
Well, one of the things that changed how we designed the box is we learned that we had to do a larger box. So when you do the small like tuck box, if you have only cards, the big box stores kind of frowned upon that because they really want a game that can sit well on shelves. So that was some feedback that we got from Walmart, actually. So we've been designing our games with a much bigger box to sit on a shelf. They don't want it too big and they don't want it too small. So we're kind of in the middle with our most recent game, Big Big Boom, that just dropped.
I always found it interesting when I've designed games on the more mass market side that when you look at a Target shelf, you tend to see like the party games or like the adult party games is a good example, that Cards Against Humanity box size is what almost all of them are in the shape of. And the reason for that is if one of those games don't do especially well, it gets pushed out, but it leaves the same physical space measurement wise. And in order to put a new game down, it needs to fit in that spot, which is why so many companies tend to adjust their box sizes depending on the demographic and what section that the game might end up sitting on the shelf. And so I always found that interesting that when you start out, you don't tend to know those things. It's more like, oh, I want it to be compact. I want people to be able to throw it in the purse, take it with them. But then if the game is successful and they do land it in a big box store, they do have to make these new boxes that are much larger than they need to be a lot of times, have way more air in the inside, but they pop a lot more on the shelf so people will actually buy it. And so it's those trade-offs that I always find interesting.
Yeah, that's something we learned the hard way. We actually created a game that was the right size, but it wasn't the right width. So you tried to stand it up, it would fall over. That was a hard lesson to learn. So now we're making games that are the right sizes just in case we get into those big box stores.
Yeah, that's hard. My previous company did specifically games made to be put in mailers on the cheapest amount for Amazon. But then they were so ridiculous and also flopped over when you put them on a shelf. So that kind of put them in an awkward state where it's like, do we put a hang tag on it? Like, how do we present this now? Do we make like an interesting pop box? But then when someone has it at home, where do they put it? Kind of fits in a bookshelf, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, lots of things to consider for sure.
And since you are creating party games and more approachable games, what do you consider when you are making design choices to keep within that audience?
One thing that we always test are the instructions. As you know, you can think you have easy to read instructions and you don't. So listening to people read your instructions will tell you if your game is overly complicated. Some people like those overly complicated games. I don't. And I find that when games are too complicated, it turns people off and they'll just not play your game and play something that's easier to learn. Like, people don't read instructions. Don't let me say that. A lot of people don't read instructions, especially like at a party, right? If you're bringing a party card game, people are drinking. No one wants to sit there and listen to someone read instructions for 5 minutes on how to play. They just want to kind of pick it up. So when we're testing, if people can't just kind of pick up the game in a round or two, then we know it's too complicated and we'll try to dumb it down. We don't want it like super duper easy, but we find that it needs to be easy and fun. And yeah, that's kind of the winning thing. But if people are stumbling on the rules, you're going to have a challenge of getting them to play consistently, I find.
Yeah. And with party games, a lot of times you just keep playing until you're done or you've had a lot of fun. There's not always a score system. For Song Survivor, what did you make as its like score system to be the winner?
The score system is basically, it's pretty traditional. If there's a judge and the judge each round gets to pick which song they like the most, and it's usually the ones that people are singing. And so they award them the card, and the card counts as 1 point. But you're right, we've gone back and forth on some of the games that we're designing because my partner, his name is Garrett, he's awesome. He's always about, it's not about the score, it's just about having a good time. And I come from the perspective of, it's still a game though, and somebody has to win. Like, it's not necessarily a game if there's not a scoring system and there's a clear winner. And so we usually find the happy medium. But the scoring system for that game is really just the card, because it's easy. It's easy to keep score when you have three cards in front of you. You know, John has 3 points.
That's awesome. And how many points are you trying to reach in order to win?
I think we have two different modes. I don't have the game in front of me, but I think it's 5 cards is one mode. And there's a diva mode that's, I think that one, they need 5 cards. I don't know how my game works, to be honest.
Totally fine. I'm sure it's been a bit since you've played or worked on it. So I guess time-wise, are we thinking from the initial inspiration of you being on vacation and people crashing your little sing-along to the game actually being out for people to buy and play? How long time-wise was that?
We moved pretty fast. So from concept to being in the market can be about 3 to 5 months. It just really depends. We have a pretty good system in place. Song Survivor, we kind of got lucky because, you know, it made Oprah's favorite things list, and then it kind of went wild from there. And then, you know, a couple different celebrities played it. And that's kind of our model now, is we're trying to get our games into as many celebrities' hands as possible, because we find that to be the cheaper way of marketing. And then, you know, whatever they do or post, then we can just kind of market that.
So how did Oprah get it in her hands? I'm very curious.
We were part of an accelerator, and they found us, and they were looking for games, and we submitted 3 games, and that's the one that they liked. They asked for one, and then they asked for 4 more, and then we didn't hear anything for a long time, and then we got this letter that, you know, hey, you made Oprah's favorite things list, and we had to sign these documents that we could talk about it ahead of time, and you know, then it launched and we sold out. And for those who are listening, if you ever make that list, whatever games you have, you need to like times 10 in terms of production, because it sells out fast, and that's a horrible thing to have a lot of demand and you don't have enough games. And that's what happened to us. We had so much demand, they actually listed us twice the following year. So yeah, just please have enough games if you ever make that list.
Interesting. So what did you do when that happened, when you realized that you were selling out very fast?
We kind of panicked. And
okay.
We, you know, it's the holiday season, and you know, we couldn't make games fast enough because we make our games in China and it takes a while for them to get here. So they were kind of angry at us for not having enough games, because they told us to have a lot, but we kind of underestimated the power effect of Oprah. And you know, what was a lot to us, it was not a lot to her audience.
Yeah, apparently.
So yeah, but it's a common problem that they have when you're kind of a young company. You know, you have to have a big budget to make a lot of games, like 20,000 games or something like that. Very, very expensive. So for our budget, we did that and beyond, and we were still short. You know, it's good to sell out, but you know, it would have been nice to have more, for sure.
No, that is always a hard thing to try to forecast for. And I mean, how would you know that a celebrity would be like,
exactly. Yeah, we had no idea. So
no, that's pretty amazing though. You said your now marketing strategy is trying to get games in the hands of celebrities. So how are you approaching that? Are you just like going around LA and say, hey, you, I'm Stone, you want to play my game?
No, we're actually looking for celebrities that kind of fit the theme of our games, and we'll reach out and give them reasons why they should partner with us. That's one thing that we're doing. We're also investing in the Oscars this year, so we're getting some of our games in the Oscar gift bags that they give out, and we're utilizing our network of friends. I live in Los Angeles. My partner, he's here, and he comes from Hollywood, so we're trying to use our network to get our games into their hands. And a buddy of mine, we're trying to convince him to do a TV show. He's a producer, like a reality TV show of celebrities playing card games. So we're really trying our hardest to get these games out there because there's so much competition nowadays. We have to think outside the box.
Oh, yeah, I would say starting up a reality TV show about board games could go a few different ways. It could go real good or real boring or just super nerdy.
That's true. That's true. We think we have a good concept, so we'll see. In one of our games, Who'd You Rather, a producer actually optioned it to turn it into a game show. It kind of falls into that show. Remember the show Ridiculousness? It was on for like 20 seasons. This guy's name is Rob, and he used to be a skateboarder. Anyway, he has this like blooper type show that's been on forever, and so we think we can do something similar. So, but the film industry is changing so much right now, just like a lot of industries due to AI. So, we'll see what happens.
That's really interesting, though. I'm always curious how some of those games get created into reality TV because when I was younger, I used to watch like the Game Network. I do not now. I rarely watch reality TV anymore, but like the Newlywed Game was actually one that I really enjoyed, or Baggage when I was a kid, which I should not have been watching either of those. But I think that's really cool.
I think it's relationships. I think almost everything is relationships, is what I'm learning as I get older. So, the only reason that we got our game option is because it was somebody we knew in the film industry, and they knew someone who was looking to get into the card game, well, game shows. And we said, hey, we have the perfect game to translate into a game show. And then we got them to play it. They loved it, and then they optioned it. So it just comes down to relationships.
I completely agree. Networking is huge in every industry, but you're being able to have that cross-population between, or pollination, I guess, between the film industry and board games is pretty legit.
Yeah, and we haven't seen too much of it yet, so we think there's something there. And celebrities are always looking for new ways to make money that where they don't have to do a lot. And so we see this as one. They don't really have to do anything but really either play the game, let us film it, and then we could push that, and then just take pictures with it, and then that can be reoccurring revenue for them, forever, depending on how good the game is. So that's kind of our pitch to these celebrities. This is a new way to connect with your audiences.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that Instagram has this new like collaborating feature too, where if you have an influencer or a celebrity on their personal account posting a video, they can add you and collaborate and it'll be posted on both sides. That is a really cool tool.
That is super cool. Nice. I need to be more active on social media. That's kind of our weakness. Me and my partner are not really on socials that much. And those who are, and they're building a community, of course, is very beneficial. I think that's how Exploding Kittens broke their records. But, I don't know. We kind of suck at it.
That's true. You have to feel very passionate. I know for this podcast last year, I started launching short form videos that are slowly growing. And it's funny because TikTok is like twice as many followers as Instagram, even though I do love the collaborating feature. But that's all about like 1 minute or less talking about a question or where the inspiration for something came from. Because I realized quickly that not everyone has the mental energy to listen to a podcast that's like 30, 40 minutes. But they can watch a video that's 30 seconds to 60 seconds. So it's like, all right, different audience, or maybe the same audience, but different media format. So let's give it a shot.
Yeah, they say that. Is TikTok changing now? I haven't jumped on recently, but they said since it's been bought, it's kind of acting different. Are you experiencing that at all?
I definitely don't scroll through because my algorithm is crap now. I actually deleted when I thought it was going away forever. And my algorithm has never bounced back. So I mostly post on it and respond to comments, which is not especially helpful for your question. But for Song Survivor, how is the game doing now that it's been out for a bit?
It's doing pretty good. It's kind of maintaining, so it's not growing, but we had a pop during the holiday season because they relisted it on the website of Oprah's Favorite Things, but we've kind of moved on to some other games that we're trying to push and get into different markets. So Pick Pick Boom was a recent game that came out, which is kind of like competitive show and tell. It allows you to incorporate your cell phone and, you know, there's a card with a description or two cards that have descriptions. And then you have to race to come up with a picture and tell a short story about it. And then we have a Latino version of Would You Rather, which is our most popular game that is coming out soon. And so we're kind of leaning into the expansions on that. And that's kind of where our focus is now.
That is super interesting. So why focus that direction for the expansion?
Because it's a huge market, we kind of live in exploring markets that are just not as tapped in. In short, we make games for the culture, but like we feel that the Latino market, there's something there. We're also looking at exploring making games for the LGBTQ market, just because that's who we hang out with. And these are, you know, so we want to make games that kind of reflect us and our friends and that are not oversaturated. That's where we feel the opportunities are, kind of leaning in those directions.
No, I think that's great. I mean, I am a lesbian, so I love that for me, that there's going to be potentially more games that fit my culture. I know I have a game coming out this year that's called Pride Pursuit, and it's a 18-card escape room game about Pride Month. And so these like weird slices of life, it's always fun to see from the perspective of the people that live it.
Yeah, that's awesome. If you ever need people to test, we're here for you.
Noted. I appreciate that a lot, especially if you're making fun party games. I love throwing a good party. I channel my inner queer when it comes to Halloween. It is gay Christmas and any kind of party I put themes on. I had a couch warming party. It was very fun. We had tropical drinks and we just sat on my couch and warmed it. So it was a good time.
Wait, you just sat on your couch and warmed it?
Yeah. Look, I can't afford a house, so I'm not having a housewarming party, but I can afford a new couch set.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I love the creativity, though. Your idea of a show-and-tell game, I love that. I am definitely the person that'll start saying a story and then quickly be like, wait, I have a picture on my phone, and then I'll like pull it up to help improve the story. So that would be a game that I would enjoy.
Yeah, you would love Pick, Pick, Boom.
And it sounds like you've been working on a ton of really awesome projects, but we're going to wrap up this episode with one last question. Unrelated to any game that you've worked on, what is a game that you wish you had designed?
You know, one game that I wish I designed was Pictionary. That's a classic game, and I'm a visual person, and it's super easy. And every time I play it with people, we have a blast. It's crazy how the universe works, because the creator of Pictionary, his name is Rob Angel. I met him and asked him to be an advisor, and he's an advisor to doing the most games. So not only is that my favorite game created, or one of them, that one in Uno, he's able to be on our team and we can call him and ask for advice. And we've actually designed some games for him because he still pitches in the industry. And so that's been an amazing relationship. But Pictionary is the game that I wish I would have created.
That is very interesting. I'm guessing you've read his book, Game Changer, the story of Pictionary.
Yes, I have it. He signed it. He signed a Pictionary game for me that I have in my office. Yeah, he's a cool dude.
That is so awesome, because I got that book for free by going to a game convention, and I was like, oh, interesting. I started reading it, and I'm like, wow, was it wildly different back then? The way of sourcing product, like just the materials and how he did it in his apartment. I was just like, this is so fascinating. Or driving around to like Barnes and Noble or whatever store he was inside of and pitching the game to like random ongoers. It's just such a different way of doing things compared to now, especially with you talking about AI and how every industry has been changing. But that book was interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's an amazing, interesting dude, like super down to earth. Super spiritual, which you wouldn't think that this guy is like a spiritual guy, but he is like, I'm like super spiritual, like at a high level, like connected to spirits. So he talks about that. He talks about making games. He's kind of all over the place, but he's just a fun guy with great energy. Yeah, we're grateful to have him on the team.
That is super cool. Okay, well, this has been the most interesting answer to that question.
Well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, and I appreciate everyone who's been listening to this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 138, Song Survivor. But Edwin, I know we touched a little on social media and that maybe you're not as good at it, but is there anywhere you want people to be following you?
Sure. Our Instagram, @doingthemost, and our website is doingthemostgames.com. Our TikTok is @doingthemostgames, so please check us out.
Excellent. And I've been your host. I'm Danielle Reynolds. If you're trying to find my personal social media, I have an Instagram under the name Token Gamer, spelled GAYMER, as well as those fun short form videos I mentioned under Game Design Unboxed, both on Instagram and TikTok. So check those out. And Edwin, thank you so much for being on the show. This was a super cool interview.
Thank you for having me again, and have a good night.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out NoDirectionPodcasts.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out All Play at Let'sAllPlay.com. Join us next time.